No. And we're back with the Digital Press Podcast, episode 9. And today we are starting off our discussion with the newly published, straight off Kickstarter, Retro Magazine.
A Kickstarter that actually worked?
It's nice. There's more and more of the retro gaming Kickstarters and classic gaming things of worth that are making it through Kickstarter, I think. I think that's really... That's the hallmark. That's the litmus. If something is worth it, it's going to get the correct amount of appeal, and it's going to make it.
It's definitely well-published. Like, I've seen, magazines that were, retro magazines that are clearly, have ways to go.
Like a fanzine.
Yeah, fanzine.
This doesn't feel like a fanzine.
This feels like something you can find on a store shelf. It's high-quality, paper stock. It's a nice...
super high-quality.
Put together very well.
Glossy.
Yep.
Nice glossy stock, it's well laid out. It's highly reminiscent of late era gaming publications that have either gone the way of the Dodo or folded or got absorbed into other publishing things, and their magazines went away. So it's for people who really like the physical magazine in their
bathroom. It feels like something the layout, the publishing style. It feels like something from almost 1999, 2000. Like, it's got a more modern...
Yeah, late era.
Layout.
But also, a lot of the early gaming magazines were pretty cutting edge in their layout design.
Kickstarter corner.
From a graphic design and publishing standpoint, magazines like Wired were always cutting edge with how they published their layout style almost more artistically than even for sake of readability. And some magazines like EGM it's been so long since some of these magazines were published. I'm Tips and Tricks.
Game Players.
Yeah. Those. Game Fan. Yeah, those
game
would,
pro.
Game pro. Would yeah. game, publish in a way that...
Magazines
they,
like that, though, if you open up a Game Pro or a Game Fan, it feels very 90s. This is a retro magazine that doesn't feel very 90s. It feels something that, something that would be published.
But still reminiscent of a game magazine. The kind of game magazine that we grew up on and... That have largely gone away, and that's why this Kickstarter was successful.
I have to say, I was actually shocked. I was reading it, and there were actually things in there. They were contemporary. They were talking about like indie games, some indie games today, some other projects. I've never even heard of it. I was shocked, and here I am in 2014, and I'm getting information from a magazine, a printed magazine.
And it's nice because you've got side-by-side modern game reviews along with, here you have The Wolf Among Us, episode 1 of Telltale Games, new adventure series.
Fable.
And then you've got Perfect Dark for the N64 being reviewed in a completely non-ironic fashion.
As if it just came out.
Yep. And Combat for the Atari 2600. It's really cool. For those of you who did not get in on the Kickstarter and didn't get like the first issue complimentary, I believe you can go to their website and get a subscription.
It's readretro.com. Yeah.
The founder and main publisher, SoCal Mike, who is the person behind both the Retro Gaming Roundup podcast and GameGavel.com, which is classic gaming's biggest... sister site to eBay in terms of auction for classic games and modern games.
And they had a really good interview in there with I don't know if I can pronounce his name. It was Ed.
Midway.
No. He was the guy who wrote for EGM. Right?
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Ed Simrad.
Ed Simrad. Yeah. Okay.
I thought it was a really good interview.
Yeah, I was pleased with my first issue. It just felt strange to have a physical magazine in my hand.
Do you feel about that? Like in terms of, it's a big undertaking. Publishing a magazine is not an easy thing. So how do you feel about taking on that challenge in 2014? Do you think this is something that has potential, or is it something that's sort of like just holding on to that last bit of,
Well, this is the community to do that for, right? If you're ever going to make something for a community that loves holding on with their last dying breath to an outdated format. Classic gaming, for sure. I think they'll, you know, they'll keep them floating in terms of subscriptions.
The print, you know, I don't know what their margins are or anything like that, but to produce this magazine, printed form, send it out, I mean, I think it's very, very, it's like, you know, they were right at the razor's edge from where their Kickstarter was to actually be able to make the printed form. It's also available digitally. You can buy it digitally, but subscribe digitally. But, you know, from what they were saying is, you know, the starting up and putting all that together in an actual printed magazine is not cheap.
What magazines did you guys subscribe to as a youngster?
I'm still subscribed to Game Informer.
Oh, okay.
That's
still,
right? Yeah, I mean, GameStop owns that.
GameStop is their lifeline.
Yeah.
I had Game Players, which then became Ultra Game Players, which then became Game Buyer for like 5 issues, which then transferred to Next Generation. And then I wound up subscribing to and still maintaining my Game Informer subscription, which is pretty much your only option at this point.
Yeah, I had Game Informer. Yeah. I subscribed to Nintendo Power from the earliest ones. I was a good friend of the podcast. Stephanie was talking online on the I Am a Classic Gamer Facebook page about the Nintendo Power, like who had the Nintendo Power. Or someone asked and she had commented and I had responded that I had the first two printed Nintendo Fun Club newsletters that were just like cardboard. Yeah. They were just like paper stock and you can unfold them. They're almost like a map or something. And then they sent me the first one with the printed cover, I think was the Zelda one or the RC Pro-Am one. Was it the Zelda one? And I was like, wow, a magazine. Like I was so excited. I think they just sent me that free, like you just sent in your warranty card on one of your early Nintendo games and they started sending those out. And that hooked me for a long time. I think I was a Nintendo Power subscriber all the way through like the N64 era, and then I let it like.
Yeah, I subscribed to Nintendo Power. Probably I started around maybe like 1990, got it till like maybe like 1994 or something like that, and then at that point, you know, staying just exclusively Nintendo didn't work for me, so I started getting Game Informer around 1995, and then that's just been it. My friend used to get EGM and Game Fan every now and then. He got a Game Pro or something like that, so I used to flip through his magazines too.
Yeah, that was the way to get all the latest news in school. Yeah, you would bring in your magazine and your friends would bring in theirs.
That's exactly what it was. You used to compare notes.
Yeah, exactly.
That was our social media.
Yeah,
I had Nintendo Power for maybe like 3 years, and I think I stopped because some of the other magazines, like the Game Pros and the EGMs, especially EGM, like some of my friends would actually get those, so I would just cheat and read theirs. But it got to the point where Nintendo Power never seemed like they were up to date enough, especially with the new stuff coming out. And so the other magazines had more up to date information. Yeah. And the other thing was, I mean, when they started rant on Nintendo Power, but when they started featuring as the title of the magazine, Fester's Quest.
Oh, that's pretty early on in Nintendo Power.
Yeah. It's like issue number 5 or something like that. Oh, this is done.
The cover stories on Nintendo Power were never any indication, especially in the early days of... I mean, in the Fester's Quest cover in that era, they still didn't have a handle on reviewing for quality or like giving, you know...
It was more like a tip guide.
Too. Yeah, it
like,
wasn't, you know,
like,
the era
used to have, like,
of...
maps of the levels, yeah, exactly. And things like that.
So,
that was useful.
I'm expecting a map, a big fold-out map of a game that I actually needed the map for. And here's Fester's Quest. Come on.
Hey. So you were always just hard to please.
History looks back on Fester's Quest with some great amount of disdain, but when that game first came out, it was popular and people liked it, as far as I remember.
I remember liking that game
only
when I first played it.
In the era of the angry video game nerd, people look back on it and go like,
that game is
so terrible, it was so hard to play and not fun, but I don't remember anybody not liking it when it came out.
There were very few games.
It was surprising how popular it was, considering that this was like, a year before the Addams Family movie came out? I mean, what you had the black and white series, and then nothing, and then it was probably just a cheap license
for Sunsoft to get. Like, probably didn't cost them anything to get an Addams Family license or a license for just Fester from the Addams Family. Like, and actually, from what I understand, that game is some kind of reskin of a Blaster Master, like
similar,
thing. It was It may be a different game in Japan where they just put the Fester character in the U.S. version, or Sunsoft just had like a some type of Blaster Master game that they were working on and then dumped the assets in from the Fester. Yeah, it's one of those. We know the story.
Well, but Greg's they don't right, put Fester's though, about, Quest on Retro.
Greg's right about you know, a lot of those old magazines. It was really like a coin toss whether they would feature games that you know you were interested in. I mean, because I mean, you didn't really have again without the internet, you couldn't really look up information about whatever games you wanted. You were restricted to whatever they told you about.
Or whatever they could get an exclusive on.
Mm-hmm. They have a big feature on the Battle of Olympus from the NES that Broderbund put out. And I was reading this, and I'm saying to myself, you know, this sounds like a really interesting game, and I don't think I've ever actually played it.
It was a lot like Zelda 2.
Mainly because it had Broderbund on it.
Yeah, it's not a bad NES game. And the review, I agree with a lot of the points in the review that it was overlooked and overshadowed by a lot of other games of the era. And if this is what Retro Magazine is going to bring us, you know, fresh take, fresh look on stuff.
They got an entire section on Computer Space, which was the first retail arcade game, if you will, which was really interesting. So, I think, you know, so all in all, I think they did a great job with this, and hopefully they continue. Now, are there any things that we didn't like about it, or I know that there's some issue with the distribution of this magazine.
Yeah, it's exclusive to Play and Trade or through subscription from their site, which, you know, I understand a magazine like this getting a lock on a game chain like Play and Trade, which is, what, second to GameStop in the U.S.? Like, they're the kind of lower end GameStop. I don't want to.
Yeah, I mean.
But
well,
it's true.
Well, but, I mean, it kind of. Well, they're the only chain that's, I guess, that's retro and modern.
Yeah. And they don't have...
Well, they're franchises. Yeah. GameStop is just... Every GameStop you see is owned by GameStop.
Right, it's corporate.
Yeah. Okay. These are... Play and Trade is franchise. I don't know what...
And Play and Trade did not have their own Game Informer style magazine. So in that respect, it's a get. But on the other hand...
How many Play and Trades are there? I mean, I don't think there's that many.
I don't know. I would like to see them be able to distribute in non-Play and Trade locations. I mean, part of the fun of a magazine like that is going to the newsstand, you know, and just buying it because you need something to read, or you're on vacation, or something like that. And I'm not going to be able to get Retro unless there happens to be a Play and Trade wherever I am.
Unless it's like really, really successful, and eventually they can expand it.
Yeah, I would advise that they do if they can find a way to ice cold beer. If they can find a way to distribute beyond Play and Trade, if their exclusivity ever, you know, ends. That would be good for stores like Digital Press here, you know, because we, you know, obviously have a lot of room for magazines.
Diamond Day.
Yeah. All right. So any final thoughts on Retro?
My only disappointment was the prevalence of modern stuff on it. Like the cover, it's for the very first issue
on
a magazine called Retro is a game that is coming out. Mm-hmm. Mighty Number 9. I mean, I get the logic behind it because it's probably
extremely hard to sell anything print magazine that doesn't have at least some modern bend.
By the way, just to, you know, if anyone sees this and may be confused by the name of the magazine, there is another magazine called Retro Gamer that is published out of the UK. It's not, I mean, they ship it to the United States, costs a little bit more and a lot more money, but that is a totally different magazine. It is not this magazine. And that magazine is almost exclusively classic gaming, collecting, etc. So that's why some people were a little bit, you know, were kind of like, well, why did they pick that name? It's the same name as this other magazine everybody knows already, but...
It's probably an obvious name to pick up.
Well, that, I mean, but that's kind of like back in the 90s. Well, there's Game Fan and there's Game Pro.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I couldn't tell the difference, so there you go.
There was EGM and PSN and IGN and...
Game Players, Game Informer.
So many different...
Yeah.
How many magazines had official in their name?
Yeah, exactly.
So, I think this is something that's good for us in the classic gaming world, and it's I always am cheering successes in Kickstarter that, you know, are worthy and have a lot of good support from the community. But, you know, success or failure is yet to be seen. We will see in the future. This is issue number one. Mm-hmm. So they have a long, hard road ahead of them. And they seem to, you know, have a huge stable of writers, people who have written for gaming websites, gaming blogs, gaming magazines. Too much to even, like, go through, but yeah. it's a who's who of editors and authors and bloggers and reviewers from a lot of sources that you've probably heard of and you're probably aware of. So they have that going.
I believe my analogy was it was like the Eric Bischoff era WCW wrestling stable where there was like
they
literally
was buying every single
80
whatever
guys.
They could get. Yeah.
Yeah, anyone who was and not women. Currently employed by Vince McMahon, Eric Bischoff was putting on the payroll. So you had like the mid card of every WWF superstar from the 80s and like the main event of like a couple regular WCW guys.
Well, they had three shows, and each show had its own stable.
Yeah, it was crazy.
So here we are for another fun segment for collectors. A segment we call Fun Segment for Collectors.
That sounds like fun.
Or Who We Don't Like. Oh, wait, am I
not way to start it off. So, you know, one of the things, I guess, about being collectors, or to some degree, is how much of a collection can you accumulate over time? And there is now a winner. The winner is Michael Thomason of Buffalo, New York, who the Guinness Book of World Records recognizes as having the largest video game collection in the world. At somewhere
like 11,000,
yeah,
11,000, I think it is.
Approximately 11,000 games.
Impressive.
The exact criteria of what that is, we don't exactly know, but that's sort of why I wanted to talk to you guys about this a little bit. It's fascinating that it came up. I've had conversations with people who have very large collections, and there's a mixture of good for him and I should be that guy. Why didn't they come to me?
Well, don't you have to, for the Guinness Book of World Records, don't you have to sort of like nominate yourself for them to, and instead?
Isn't
that how that works?
I've heard, and I haven't talked to Michael about this specifically, but from what I heard, he didn't go to them.
Really?
They did come to him. I don't know how exactly.
Somebody else might have tipped them off.
Somebody might
like
have
that.
Nominated
yeah.
him.
What
I mean,
did they go on the forums?
He's been part of our, you know, our gaming community for quite a long time. You know, his name had probably been out there, and you know, he has enough friends where somebody could have just said, "Start with Mike," you know. And I would imagine that for almost any sort of world record, somebody has to start it out. Like he may not have the highest collection
yeah.
next Some, year.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody right? else comes in.
But somebody's got to start it.
Well, there,
so
there
you
was
can't
another
be too
guy.
Outraged.
Yeah. Because there was another person, I don't remember his name, but there was another person before him who had like 10,700 games.
Oh, so somebody was actually ousted for the. I thought he
right.
was the inductee, like the very
no,
first charter member. No,
I think there was
really?
Someone else,
huh, so why,
literally
why
right before him.
Yeah.
So why was it a big deal this time?
Yeah, that is a good question. I wasn't aware that there was a prior champion.
Like I actually,
who was it? Anyone
I actually
we know?
Saw this on non-gaming websites. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my aunt sent me a newspaper article saying, "Why is this not on the newspaper? You know, don't you do this?" You know, like. So, what actually is kind of an interesting question. This is really the thing that I wanted to talk to you about, and I would like to hear each of your opinion on this. If you had or thought you had the largest video game collection in the world, would you want it to be publicized? Would you want it on every newspaper across the country and news station?
I mean, I would probably say maybe. See, the thing is, I'm not special, so I try to imagine myself if I ever were.
You're very special.
No, thank you. No, but in all seriousness, I think that it's one of those things where it's a double-edged sword. It's like, do you want the publicity? And the question is, why do you want the publicity? That's what I would ask myself. It's like, because if I'm sitting there and saying, you know, what is it for? Is it for bragging rights? Is it for some other, you know, is it an itch that I have to scratch? If it's an itch that I feel like it needs to be scratched, then yeah, I probably would. But if it's just like, you know, hey, we want to put your name on the paper just because? I don't know. I mean, if I didn't feel like I was getting anything out of it, I probably wouldn't. I would have to have some reason, like personal reason why.
So just your name up there in lights wouldn't be.
Yeah, you know, it's like, I mean, other than the novelty of it.
It's got to be kind of a thrill. Like, he can share this with his family and his friends. Yeah,
If there's a thrill to it and you think that thrill is worth it, then by all means, you know, but doing it just to do it, I probably wouldn't.
Well, I think I don't want to generalize, but you have like two different types of collectors, essentially, from what I've seen. You have people who will go onto web forums and Facebook and different places like that who have large collections and even small collections, and they like to show off their Room of Doom and their game room and all that. Some of them are really, like, you look at it like, wow, I mean, they spent like months putting this whole room together with special rug and these shelves and that shelf and whatever. And some of them are really impressive, and some are just like, yeah, or whatever. So I could easily see there being enough of those guys who are already looking to share what they have. So, yes, I want to be number
one. Well, now it's a competition.
Number one, yes.
That's what it is now.
Yeah. But, not a good time to be a seller.
Yeah. All right, but then there's the other collector, which are the guys who you never hear about. They're out there. They're on the forums and different things like that, and they collect some of the rare stuff. But nobody knows what they have. And actually, those are probably the guys who are probably well ahead of Mr. Thomas in there in terms of the size of their collection.
Right. They don't need it validated, I guess.
Or they don't want to. I mean, if that's what I'm saying. If they've never ever gone public, even within the gaming community, to say this is what I have, or this is, then they're not going to do it.
See, I feel I have gone somewhat public. Yeah, I've had pictures of my room, and I've shared. I was on programs where they talked about collecting, and to me, those things are always contained within the community. It's the nationwide recognition that I would not want any part of. I don't want some guy a couple states over knowing that the guy in Pompton Lakes has some, you know, tremendous collection.
That's the house we break into.
I would rather. It's not important enough to me to go into that sort of a thing. But you know,
but do you think you have this guy beat?
You know, this is one of the other conversations. Is what is the criteria?
Yeah, what counts?
Because in all of this, I've seen a lot of disputes. And one of them is this guy, Sid Bolton, who I think is Canadian, who has this, I mean, it's a monstrous collection. He's got pictures of all of his stuff online, but he's got a tremendous PC collection. Not just PCs, computers, all the way from Commodore 64, VIC-20, Atari 8-bit, PC DOS stuff, but like rooms full, like this whole store, imagine, just full of all unique. And you look at that and you're like, that's more than 11,000 games in that picture.
But they didn't count computer games.
So I don't know if that means computer cartridges also don't count.
Right.
Yeah.
CD-ROMs, diskettes, I assume, don't count. So I wouldn't even know. I wouldn't even know where I fit into.
Maybe they'll do that next year.
Nor do I have any interest in counting.
Well, that's the thing too. The goal. This is one of those records that is constantly in flux. So I mean, I wonder what happens. Like every week. Somebody calls in Guinness. I bought a new game.
I don't know. Hopefully, it's at some point in the year where they just say this is the enrollment period. You know, what do you got?
Yeah, there's a cutoff.
And I remember when we were talking about this a few weeks ago, you said, why doesn't somebody make like a King of Kong of game collecting?
These guys could challenge each other. Oh, great. Now you've given my idea. It would be a great documentary to get all of the really avid game collectors together.
I'm picturing some worn down like accountant just like, 1, 2, 3,
and then you'd have, what's his name with the referee shirt there?
Walter Day.
Yeah, Walter Day would be there, of course.
There was some process for this where, and I saw it on Vimeo, where they went to his house and counted them up. Like, he was there, and there were a bunch of official type people all doing the count, and they actually counted them game by game. They didn't, you know, leave it up to him. Oh, that's right.
I mean that's what they do. But by the way, there is a third type of collector which I unfortunately kind of fall into, which is sort of like it's your collection is just kind of messy and you don't know exactly.
Yeah. It's like, oh, I have that.
Oh, wait. You buy a duplicate without knowing it.
Yeah. Oh, I have 3 Nintendo World Championship cartridges. Wow. I didn't know.
I guess I'll bring this one to GameStop.
But then what do you think?
Well, I actually agree with you. I wouldn't, you know, even if I did have, which I'm far from, but if I did have the world's largest, I would just keep it to myself. Like, I haven't even posted any Room of Doom pictures online. I enjoy looking at them.
It's not like having the world's largest penis. Like, then I want
everyone. Well, I am special. All right, yeah.
I am special. See, you're not competing in the right category.
I didn't know it was that impressive. It's just naturally.
Do you want to be known for that? Do you want everyone to know?
There's another perspective, too, that you would kind of want to be anonymous. Because what if you have such a large collection, and then you go to a flea market, and you find, like, this really rare game, but the seller's like, oh, wait, I saw your newspaper. That game is worth something, isn't it?
That's already happening. That's already happening.
What if Greg steals Michael Thomason's collection? Does that
become... is this like the... What if I'm traveling on a train at the speed of light and I jump out in front of the train? Am I going faster than light?
Trying to work out all the scenarios, Greg.
We should have a. We should call up Guinness. We know the person with the world's smallest collection. It's like something nothing. Just like, well, is that a record?
I have the largest number of pictures of games.
Well, then the other thing is, you know, as we're thinking about, like, what did they actually count? Did they count his loose games? Does it have to be complete in box?
Mm-hmm. Are they counting?
To most people, they may not realize that what's the big deal? They're loose versus...
Yeah, different versions of the same game.
Well, I mean,
but a game
I'll
complete...
I'll see if I can get Michael to... you know, I wish I had thought about it if we didn't come up with the topic so last minute. I would have asked him to, like, you know, maybe we could have called him and talked to him and asked him about the experience. Maybe we'll do it for the next podcast.
Yeah, maybe they'll refine their criteria for as it goes on. You know, I'm sure it's not set in stone.
There's a good argument to be made for a computer game being counted as a video game.
It is a video game.
I mean, at what point, you know, I have a Space Harrier in a box that looks exactly like the box that it came out for on a cartridge. And is it different? Because it's magnetic media?
We know what a game is. Yeah. We know what a game, definition of a game is. I mean, yes, you're not going to count Lotus 1-2-3 or, you know, Microsoft Word in a box. That's not a game. But if it's a game and it was sold at retail... It counts.
Do you include basic programming for the Atari 2600 as a game?
I would say yes, because it's a video game system. It is a video game system.
So if it's on a game console, it doesn't matter. That's probably why computer games are so hard to categorize.
So Miracle Piano would count?
Yeah.
But then why do you draw the line at, you know...
If you're making a complete collection of, say, NES...
Right.
Wouldn't that count in it?
Well, if you're saying complete game collection, I wouldn't count it. If you're saying complete NES collection, I would count it.
People
count
it, though. Software for the thing,
We'll have to get this squared away with Guinness, apparently.
Maybe we should just call them and say, hey, wait a second. Did you count Miracle Piano?
Yeah, there was one guy that just had one less game than Michael Thomas. Why? It was denied. That's good. Anything else to add? I just thought it was an interesting topic, and because of what we do, it needed to be brought up. It's kind of a landmark.
And we're back with another collecting segment, a show and tell.
My favorite segment, by the way. As a viewer, and I'm sure the other 11 viewers will also agree that this is probably one of the coolest segments, because I love seeing what you guys bring.
I never
know what you're going to bring.
The Price is Right.
And by show and tell, these are things that you own, but you didn't necessarily find them in the wild. You could have gotten them through any means.
Hey, man, I found those NES games in the garbage. There's no more wild than that.
Have been in the wild. That's wild.
That is the wild.
Well, we're not a wild story, man.
We're not limiting ourselves to the wild.
So what do you got, Joe?
Oh, I get to go first. Cool. So yes. I brought a couple of things. So I got two... Yeah, this is almost a hard one to do with this.
Yeah, and maybe you should take.
Yeah, Mike, do you want to?
That's all right. Horrible. Don't worry about it. At this point, it's going to be crazy. There are two Super Nintendo games. They're both brand new. These both came out within the last month. One of them is called, because it's actually called like 4-in-1 game. Play on Super Nintendo. It's a 4-in-1. Actually, this game was part of a Kickstarter project.
I think you really should do close-ups on these.
Do you want me to come to it?
No, take the thing off.
Yeah, you can pop off.
Okay,
there you go.
Yeah, and
because they're very cool,
this, and we got to do this for the refurb thing.
Yeah,
too,
sure,
so.
They're very cool.
So Super 4-in-1 multicart was for a Kickstarter project that this guy did, and they're all original games. Back is kind of cool; gives you kind of a better idea of what the gameplay looks like. So it's funny, but both of these claim almost the same thing. There have been no new games on Super Nintendo since 1998, but and they came out within a month of each other, which is awesome. So this was the Super 4-in-1 multicart game that was the Kickstarter, the result of the Kickstarter. And then the other one is the Super Fighter Team's latest. So Super Fighter Team is probably better known for some of the Genesis games that they did. Beggar Prince being the first that was like their big entry mm-hmm. into it, and they've done a couple since. They've done a Lynx game, and they've done a PC and Android title. This is the first Super Nintendo game that they've produced.
And that's a platformer?
It is, and it looks really, really cool. Like, I have not played this yet, but it looks so good.
Yeah.
Like, it's a little bit like a Joe and Mac mm-hmm. type of game. It's a side-scroller, two players.
Now,
did
they
looks
actually,
really tremendous, and
did
they're
they actually
very
make
talented.
This game, or is this another one that they got the license for? And just
I think it's
out?
From scratch.
Oh, really?
I do, and I think yeah. they've been doing most of their work from scratch. I think other than that first one.
I think all of their Genesis stuff was stuff.
They're
that
all
they...
pieces of games that existed.
Yeah, they...
translated. They yeah. did the
they
localization.
Got,
and they,
it's possible.
And they actually got the license for it with the original or whoever held the IP, and they actually got the license to put it out legally.
It's easy enough yeah. to find out. I mean, Super Fighter Team's website is you just superfighterteam.com. I would highly recommend you go there and check it out. They still have a lot of the stuff. The Genesis games are still available as a 3-pack. They do very quality work. They do everything right down to the box and the manual. Everything looks great. And the games themselves are really outstanding.
And for our viewers and listeners who may not know, although I doubt it, but just in case you don't, in the case of almost every game console from Atari 2600 on, there are homebrew communities that take the time and effort to make new products almost every year and all the way up into packaging and producing them. Like, so you can get new games for Atari, for Intellivision, for VIC-20, for Super Nintendo, NES, like all kinds of great stuff.
Yeah, the
so,
homebrew scene is very yeah. alive for all game consoles.
Dreamcast, there's a Dreamcast game coming out this year.
Yeah, also on Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Now, and that's and a lot of those are, especially when they come full, complete in box like that, they're a decent investment because, you know, they only make so many. And especially if
it, to make.
Yeah, and yeah. especially if it's a Super Nintendo. I know the Genesis ones for Genesis games that they made they're still making them, but the initial run that they had that had like special packaging and blah, blah, blah that people were waiting for like 5 years for, I mean, they got those and people were selling them for $300-$400
yeah.
like overnight.
So. Yeah, it's things that those completist collectors simultaneously like shake their fist like, oh, another game I need to buy. And then they buy two and they sell one for, you know, three times what it's worth.
Tell me,
after
I've been with Classic Gaming Expo for yeah. 15 years. Yeah. It's yeah, all of the games that we've released have become gigantic moneymakers to other people.
Yeah.
What do you got, Gabe? Yeah.
So I have here the Japanese version of Clock Tower, which I was not aware of until a few years ago. This is actually the precursor to the series that came out on PlayStation.
That was my first exposure to the Clock Tower series was on PS1.
But that's a game?
What's that? You exposed yourself
where? I thought
it was
a VHS
Clock Tower?
No, this is the this is the Japanese packaging for a Super Famicom.
Oh, really?
Yep. I didn't play it on Super Famicom.
Yeah, it's
VHS.
Yeah, it's meant to be vertical, which is interesting. And I actually picked this up at MAGFest 3 years ago. I just really like the cover, and I'm a big fan of adventure games, so I had to pick it up. At the time, this was the only way to get a physical copy on Super Nintendo. And then, about 2 years later, TimeWalkGames.com reproduced an English translation for it, complete in a box with shrink wrap and everything, and custom cover art. The really cool thing about these guys is that they make it look just like something that would have come out at the time.
Wait a minute. No Y-fold seal. That's a re-shrink.
Yeah, did you shrink that? Because they don't even shrink
that looks
wrap
terrible.
Their stuff, do they?
They do. This is how it came.
Huh.
Yeah, everything I've gotten from them has been shrink wrapped.
Yeah, that they didn't do a good job with. I would have taken this. I would have done the shrink wrap.
Yeah, I just haven't done it.
Note to Time Walk Games.
I just haven't taken it out because I haven't gotten around to playing the game yet. But if
you
want.
Did you actually burn through the shrink
wrap? Yeah, yeah. That it came like.
This podcast has turned into a crucifixion of Time Walks games.
Thanks for destroying the value of my repro.
I like their work, too. I have the Zelda, when they did that Zelda one that had the map.
Yeah, Parallel Worlds, or... I don't remember the name of it.
But yeah, it has like this sort of old parchment-style cover. It's really nice.
Now, the funny thing about Time Walks is when they first came out, they actually were reproducing stadium events, complete in box, there was a controversy around that. Now, to be fair, they didn't do like a perfect reproduction. Their box was like holographic. It had, you know, like you wouldn't, if you saw the box, you wouldn't mistake it for a genuine one. But there was enough controversy that they said, okay,
there's always controversy.
That's been going on forever. I mean, there was a guy that was doing some of the Comavid games. And I know because, remember from our story last time, John and Sean had bought the company.
Yeah.
And there was a guy doing reproductions, and they look so good that all of a sudden it's like, wait a minute, we have the original properties. You can't. But he was doing it. He was making something obvious on there that you'd be able to identify it. So as long as they're doing that.
Yeah. But they actually stopped making it because of the outcry.
Also, isn't this 1/8 of an inch too thin? The beer is too thin.
What are you, post on NeoGAF?
That looks good.
I brought in a few of my more rare / valuable Game & Watch games, and a great book for the aspiring Game & Watch collector. This is The History of Nintendo, Volume 2, the years 1980 through 1991, which is, for the most part, pre-NES and Famicom, and its focus is almost entirely on Nintendo's Game & Watch line, which, it's gorgeous. It's just so great. It gives so much great historical information. It gives very good information about rarity. It doesn't really get into dollar values. However, there is an iOS app that I'm going to show you guys after that. But here's the two games. This is the one that most people are interested in when I say Game & Watch. And they say, oh, do you have the Zelda Game & Watch? I say, yeah, I have the Zelda Game & Watch. It's late model. It's one of the very last ones that they made. It's a dual screen. It's pretty complex in terms of Game & Watch games. You do a lot on the bottom screen, and then when you get to a certain point, you get into the top labyrinth, and you have to fight a dragon when you collect all the Triforce pieces. It's probably, you know, the most involved Game & Watch game if you're going to sit down and play one. But it's Zelda, so people immediately, you know, recognize it. And this one, I got this one from a European seller because most of the late-end Game & Watch games were produced, manufactured, and shipped to Japan and European countries and Australia in much greater numbers than they were in the United States. So I found a much better deal on a Zelda in a region where it was more plentiful. So if you're going to be looking for a rare Game & Watch game, change your eBay settings to international and see what comes up. You may wind up with something that's cheaper. This one was my Christmas present from Joe this year, Climber, which is the most valuable one in my collection right now. And it's a rarity of like 11 out of 12. I didn't know that when I originally owned this one as a kid. It was part of my initial video game collection, and I lost it in some childhood shuffle of toys and games, and I hate it when that happens, you know. Yeah. It either went into an attic and never came out, or got sold in a garage sale without my knowledge.
I had chased the truck wagon.
Yep. It's just one of those things. A couple things you want to look for in a good Game & Watch if you're going to be looking online. Always make sure you got a battery cover. Always make sure that there's, you know, the seller does not indicate any corrosion on the battery terminals. And
is that pretty rare, though? Corrosion for those sort of batteries?
Sure, they do leak at some point under certain conditions. I mean, I have encountered Game & Watch in the wild where the battery compartment has been rusted out, you know, and it's not that green moldy corrosion that you get from C or a D cell. It goes full rust. Like it just, it goes like red corrosion. Huh. It's something in those type of cells, those battery cells. It's probably rarer than like a D cell leaking out, and the little metal stand on the widescreen ones, it's nice when it's not bent or broken. Also, the serial numbers, you know, some collectors won't touch them if they don't have a nice, fresh, complete serial number on them. No leakage in the LCD. You don't want any, like, black blobs around. That means that the game's probably not going to play right, or you're not going to be able to see anything going on. And also, if you have, if you encounter one in the wild or at a game store and you want to see if the entire LCD screen works properly, let me grab a pen really quickly. You can hit, there's a button on a Game & Watch, the ACL button. If you just tap that, it will actually go into full test mode. And all of the... Oh, it should.
Yours is broken.
Yeah.
It's supposed to show you every single character, right?
Yeah.
On the screen.
Well, that usually happens when you change the battery.
When
actually,
you change the battery, it does
Climber work. Might not actually run that way in ACL mode. That might just reset the whole thing. But ACL should give you a full test pattern of all of the stuff on the screen. This is one of the last Game & Watches made, so they probably eliminated that feature. Of course, I'm the one that I wanted to show it. And if you have an iPhone and you want to start collecting Game & Watches, there's an app called Game & Watch Collector on the Apple Store. It's free. It has every single Game & Watch game, the handhelds, the small silvers, the widescreens, the golds, the multi-screens, the tabletops, and they're all listed alphabetically. You can put them on your wanted list or your have list or your for sale list, and there's also extra features where you can hit info and you can get rarity, you can get current market value that is aggregated from eBay and other online sources. You can also hit a button and go right to eBay with it, and it'll take you right to the current listings for any of the games that you're looking for. It's a great application to have as a Game & Watch collector. These are the games in my personal collection, and then these are my wanteds, and it'll give you a statistical outline of, like, you know, what the rarities are and the values are, the ones you have, or you can look at your percentage of completion. I have 45% complete. I have almost 50% of all the Game & Watch games. It's great. It's free. It's a really great app, so I'd recommend that.
All right, well, this will be quick. This is it's a lunchbox. Child's lunchbox by Thermos.
Did you bring lunch in it?
Greg. There is no severed hands in this or anything like that.
Open it.
So it's new Super Mario Bros. Wii. And basically, this was an Amazon exclusive. With the game, you got the lunchbox, you got these little stickers that went on the the Wiimote, and it had a t-shirt. This one is in size large. And it has, you know, this t-shirt of the...
The cover.
Yeah. So, I got this off of eBay basically for the game, which is not present. That's the reason I got this. I really didn't have any... actually, I mean, if the shirt fit me, I would have kept it, but it doesn't, so...
And what are these? These are stickers?
They go on the Wiimotes.
These are things that I never understand why Nintendo or any company would produce. Physical stickers that you actually apply to your game console or your devices, your remotes or controllers. Like, this is the kind of thing in 20 years...
Yeah, I was missing some.
Oh, look at that. So some kid, like, their Wiimote in 20 years, it's going to have, like, this half ripped off, like, worn out, and you're just going to be like, damn, I don't want that controller.
Why did Nintendo do that?
Yeah,
of all people.
Of all people.
Modding their system.
Little kids.
Oh, anyway. Kids love stickers.
That's my lunchbox now, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
We got time for one more? Is there time on there? All right, I brought a bonus item, just in case we had time. This is the Acclaim, one of my favorite companies of all time, Maximum Carnage Special Edition. Now, they made these specifically for the Genesis and for Super Nintendo. They were only available through QVC. There was only 5,000 of them made, I believe, total between Super Nintendo and Sega Genesis.
Wow.
And it was packaged exactly like this for both. Other than the serial number, you wouldn't be able to tell which was which.
Now, did QVC claim that only 50 were made?
No, they said 5,000. I think that was pretty much like a standard number that was shared throughout the whole time.
Oh, yeah, it was right there, out of 5,000.
Yes. I have 1,994. 1994. This isn't open, but this is the red. The what they keep calling the special rare limited red edition. Which 95% of them are red. The gray ones are really hard to find. They're the ones I never ever see.
That's the ironic that's the rare.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Zelda, for example. Yeah. Like, you know, the gold cartridge is the one you always see. It's very hard to find the one that isn't. Or Metroid with the yellow label. You don't see that one. And it has a sort of leather-bound sort of art book, which I think has three of the actual Spider-Man comics sort of put in there. And then, of course, the three pins and certificate of authenticity. Wow. This close to getting the Super Nintendo one, too.
Nice.
I've never seen that.
Really close.
I had no idea this existed until just now. So this is like the precursor to the collector's editions that you can pre-order.
Right, it's kind of funny, right? Like, you don't see things from this generation done this way very often. So that's what makes it kind of cool.
Yeah, this is totally what you would see nowadays every game.
It's not, even though you haven't seen it, and I'm sure it's probably a new thing to a lot of people, it's not as rare as you would think. Even with only 5,000 made, maybe because people don't know about it yet. But I've seen them on eBay go for as little as $200.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah.
It originally sold for $100.
Okay.
That's not, for something like this, that's really not that crazy.
So did you were you up late at night watching QVC and like there was some lady with like big hair, sprayed hair and like a big pearl necklace, like, and the next item we have up is this Genesis Maximum Carnage set. No?
I did not. I got this from another collector. And I'm working on the Super Nintendo one from yet another collector, which I would really like to have.
So now I'm thinking, like, how much is out there from like QVC and stuff that none of us would have ever cared about at the time, because we'd be like, oh, that's just more QVC crap.
Well, I mean, if you do enough research on the web, you'll find. I mean, this has been known for a while. I'm not announcing something that nobody knows about. It's been talked about. It's been talked about, and you know, somewhere there was a website. In fact, I was like, how many did they make? I know it says that on there, but let me just see. And I looked it up even before today just to see, and there was a couple of websites that had like the rarest, you know, Genesis games, and this was listed as one of them, even though really there was one on eBay that had sold on January 6th of this year for $207. Had a bunch of bids on it, but
go crazy. Is there anything about that box that you couldn't swap in, like a
book company?
No, this, you mean?
Yeah. Is there anything about the packaging on that?
Not that I'm aware.
Okay.
I wouldn't think so.
Not that I'm aware.
I don't think they would have gotten into trouble.
Did that? I'm trying to remember if that red cartridge sticker was on the.
This is still shrink wrapped, right?
Yeah.
This looks like it's actually on the shrink wrap.
It's on the shrink wrap.
Yeah, but I mean, I may be wrong about this, but I think in most of them, the MA-13 is black. I could be wrong about that, though.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty subtle.
I don't have one.
You don't have one?
No.
It doesn't really matter because it's part of the whole set anyway. Sure. So.
But yeah, like if you had an incomplete set, could you stick a standard retail in there to replace it? Would you be able to tell that? And I don't know the answer to that.
Oh, well.
Ironically, that's the least interesting piece of the whole. And it's a good game. And did you know that Maximum Carnage was actually programmed by LJN? The despised game company that was bought out by Acclaim.
Yep.
So Acclaim bought them and LJN did it. So LJN didn't make all bad games, because that's a good game. I like Maximum Carnage.
Well, technically, LJN didn't make any games. They just farmed everything out.
Well, right. But their team, whoever their team
was. There's a guy on the internet now, the LJN defender. Like,
is that right?
Yeah.
That's a tough job.
Oh, God.
That's a tough job.
Yeah, I like Friday the 13th. I think that's a fun game.
I actually like that one, too.
If I had to pick one LJN game, because you can beat it. It's hard, but it's not impossible, and you know, you can figure it out, and it's, you know, nostalgia. Yeah.
As a kid, I thought it was a scary game.
Jason, when he's in those cabins, it's legitimately like a jump scare.
Oh, crap!
When you turn, and there's this big purple, like, what the
And sometimes when you're walking, he just runs by you, and you're like,
"Yep,
what the
he dashes
hell?
In."
Did they do the X-Men game too?
Oh, now that's a whole that's notoriously.
One real fast thing with LJN, I saw this. This has probably been out for a long time, but the Back to the Future game on the NES, which they did, which most people don't like.
Yeah.
But one of the things about it is, you know, people make fun of the music. They're like, "What is this music?" It's like, like, it sounds terrible. Well. I think, I don't know how somebody discovered this recently or whatever, but I saw on YouTube there was someone who slowed it down to a specific... No, they slowed the music down and changed the tempo a little bit. And I swear, if you do that, it is a perfect, you know, MIDI version of Power of Love by Huey Lewis.
Really?
So clearly, whoever programmed... And somebody posted on one of the forums...
They probably just couldn't get the rights to use Power of Love.
Never had it. Somebody posted it on one of the forums, and then there was a guy who... replied and said, oh yeah, you know, I worked on games and stuff like that, and I worked for the company that developed that game. It, well, not LJN, but whoever they pay, I forget who it was, they paid to develop it. And he's like, yeah, you know, my friend worked on it, and that's probably what they did. They probably just left it in there and just sped it up.
That's so funny.
So it's really funny that somebody, they actually redid like the title screen of the Back to the Future game, and it's, you know...
What makes somebody think to do that? I wonder if I slow this down, if it'll sound like...
They might, maybe they have a really good ear for music.
So look at
someone real talented. Yeah, not somebody with just an incredible amount of free time.
Or it could be both. They don't have to be mutually exclusive.
I suppose not.
Because classic gamers have tons of better things to do.
And with that,
yep.
Yes.
I believe we are done.
All right, welcome back. This is something we get asked a lot about cleaning. Things about you know, how to properly take care of games, how to get ink off, how to get stickers off, and being the digital press store, that they have a lot of experience dealing with this, cleaning things up. So we're gonna go over the different techniques employed to
clean, restore, repair, renew,
keep all of your stuff looking and, you know, so
how do you turn
fresh.
Garbage into gold? That's what it comes down to.
Straight from the masters of the archives.
Because imagine working in a store like this, and people walk in off the street with a box of dirt, and somewhere in the dirt there is a game controller or several Nintendo 64 cartridges with marker all over them under the dirt.
How do you clean it without destroying the actual
How do you do that? Do you present this to another person who might say, I'd like to buy that cartridge with dirt and marker
on it? In my many years of managing a Funko Land store, one of my most frequent questions that I asked people with a trade-in box was, did you have these buried in the backyard for safekeeping? Because they were literally had dirt on them. Like, not just dust that you get from leaving something on a shelf and in an unswept state for many months or many years. Dirt. Brown
bugs.
Dirt.
Oh, right, those little like silverfish, they're all over the place.
So let's talk about some of the most common ones, right? First of all, we all know that the enemy of the game cartridge is dust. Mm-hmm. Dirt, dust, corrosion on the actual pins. And all that's really happening is it takes the slightest little problem on one of those pins, a little bit of dirt, it's not making connection with one of those pins inside, not going to work at all. Our technique, who would like to take this one?
Gabe, you're right in front
of it. Oh, always has to be me.
You have a cartridge with a dirty...
Here, let me make that...
Oh, yeah.
All right, here.
Well, now, what's wrong with what Frankie just did? Anyone?
Everything. First of all, he snatched it out of my hand. You never snatch anything.
That's right. It's dangerous. It's dangerous.
Well, the misconception is that blowing into the cartridge clears it of dust, but what it really does is it introduces moisture from your breath into the contacts.
It's smelly.
Which may actually help the connection at first, but you know, the saliva will cause corrosion.
There is electrical conductivity to saliva, you know.
Sure. It'll work that one time, but it doesn't. But over time, it'll make things worse.
You are removing some dust from it by blowing.
Yes.
Possibly,
I mean, it's not that you're not removing dust. Yeah. You are, but it's...
But it's not the removal of the dust. It's not the removal.
Right. Some of you may have read an article that was shared a lot on the internet from a website called Mental Floss, also a magazine. I was interviewed by Chris Higgins about the phenomenon of blowing into Nintendo cartridges, which was like a hive mind thing that everybody did in the 80s when their game didn't work. And above and beyond the problems that blowing physical human moisture onto these electronic leads, that's definitely problematic. There's very little doubt in anybody's mind that causes long-term damage if done repeatedly over and over again without any other kind of cleaning applied to it. My biggest speculation is that just the mere act of removing a Nintendo cartridge, blowing in it, and reseeding it multiple times, between 1 and 10 times, you would net the same positive effect of the game working by just taking it out and putting it back in 10 times. Because all you're really doing is moving the connection in a microscopic like manner.
You're moving the dust a little more.
You are. The blowing really probably did nothing. It was just the physical act of removing and reinserting that was doing more for the connection than anything else.
Well, it was the placebo effect.
Absolutely. Yes.
So what is the ultimate technique?
Alcohol.
Yep.
Rubbing alcohol.
Beer?
Beer, yes.
That too.
Beer. I'm actually just, I'm not going to use the top because screw tops.
He likes to dip his wick.
What kind of alcohol correct. Is this? Any idea? We're just we're
Rainbow
talking about
Technology. They are the specialists.
It is literally the most common alcohol you can possibly find in a pharmacy.
Off the shelf.
It's usually 99% isopropyl alcohol. The less water in it, the better. So 99% is perfect.
And the reason that you want a high alcohol content is because of the rapidity of how it evaporates, like how quickly it goes away. Once it's on, if you watch it with your eyes, you can actually see the moisture disappear, like really quickly.
Maybe we can catch it in real lifetime.
Now, what about all those
on
alcoholics
our HD flip cam?
What about all those alcoholics out there that might not have, you know, rubbing alcohol at home? Do you think vodka would do the same thing?
No. Vodka has some degree of sugar in it, and you want no residue whatsoever. Yeah. This sort of alcohol is completely clean and free of anything but alcohol.
Take your alcohol-dipped cotton swab, because, once again, screw tops. Just go back and forth on the cartridge leads, both sides.
And this is basically what Nintendo and Sega used to sell to people, right? Yep. Those like cartridge cleaners.
And you definitely do not need to be gentle if you're using a Q-tip.
Even though on the back of most NES cartridges it says do not use
and
isopropyl alcohol.
You can actually see all of the gray
in low definition.
Yep. Just
trust us, it's gross.
Yeah.
Just knowing that there's that kind of level of oxidation.
Dude, what did you eat? What's going on here?
What did you blow into that cartridge?
It's the cancer. It comes out in my breath.
Great, now I look like an asshole. Thanks.
Yeah. So
it even sounds gross.
A decent amount of scrubbing like that.
Yeah, and you know what? This is probably just going to keep getting grayer and grayer no matter how many times you do it.
Well, the trick is you do that until your Q-tip comes out white. And these are not expensive things. Alcohol and Q-tips are very, very cheap. So,
which you should already have in the house anyway.
No.
You should, you disgusting animal.
You filthy animal. While this is an absolutely A1 technique for cleaning cartridges with metal contacts on them, if you ever do get a cartridge that has, like, legitimate corrosion on it, like green built up mold or some type of growth that has come out of the oxidation. And I've seen them. I'm sure you've seen them. Sometimes the rubbing alcohol and the Q-tip alone don't necessarily restore the leads back to full luster. I have found great success in using non-conductive metal polish. Brasso or Sheila Shine, those you can find those at your local hardware stores like Home Depot. Those can be applied to really serious cases of corroded metal, and 9 times out of 10, I've actually been able to restore. So, like I was saying, just make sure if you're going to use a metal polish that it's non-conductive, because what you're going to be putting into your game system is going to conduct electricity, so you don't want to blow it out with anything that's conductive. It'll say on the can or the tube that it's non-conductive.
Another real quick thing I always tell people when they're using alcohol and cleaning their games like this is that it's okay to have it completely soaked. That cartridge can be completely soaked and put it in the system and pull it back out, because the same alcohol that's helping those cartridge pins is helping the pins inside the system as well. So there should be no fear. Don't do any of these things with the power on, but it's absolutely safe for alcohol inside your system.
You should probably also unplug your system so that there's no store
all
charge.
The typical safety things that you would think of should probably execute those as well.
So this cartridge also belongs to Mike, apparently. So we'd like to donate this to you.
Yes.
Congratulations. You can get your Grand Prix on, if you will.
Now, so the reason why that's there, Mike would never do such a thing.
Own a copy of F1 Racing for N64.
But once again, rubbing alcohol is a cure-all for things that you might not have normally expected it to be a cure-all.
Look at that.
I don't even have to push hard.
That was like a friggin' Sharpie.
Yeah.
permanent.
Most people don't think of using rubbing alcohol to take black marker off of things, or red marker, or any color marker, but it's great on plastic. It's not great on labels. You don't want to do that unless you're going to be really, really careful at first just to sort of see how it's taking. Some labels have a little bit of a plastic coating that are safe from alcohol. Most do not. When it comes to marker on labels that you care about, you have to be extremely careful. And the best thing is behind you, Frankie, there's a bottle of generic Goo Gone, which is very much like alcohol, but it's a little bit less abrasive.
It's a more oily base.
It's a little safer. I know people that swear by that on cartridge labels. I do not.
Yeah, don't they put orange in there because of the acidity of it?
It's probably, yeah.
But it's more effective than alcohol. I wouldn't go out at a label with alcohol, period. But with that, I might try it. I might want to see how it affects on with just a touch. If it's a marker, your label's already fucked, right? Mm-hmm. So
a little
Goo Gone on it to wipe it out isn't going to kill it, but I would test it out first.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't. I wouldn't tell anybody to shy away from experimenting with it, but my personal experience with Goo Gone is that if you get it, even if you're just very lightly trying to remove something from... Like, this does have some sticker residue on top of this sticker, so let's see if I can get that off.
Yeah, well, spray it on the towel. Never spray it directly.
Exactly. Yeah, good point. My problem has been, though, that the area that you treat...
I spray it on my hand first.
The area that you treat winds up with a kind of a halo of the oil from the Goo Gone afterwards, like after you've treated it and it's dried up. No, I'm not really seeing too much come up, but...
Actually, I've had success using Goo Gone on Super Nintendo boxes, and it doesn't damage the labels.
Yeah, like I said,
anything.
Everyone's mileage varies, and the type of cardboard or the label itself, it all depends on what you're up against.
Now, but here's the problem. See, now, some of the gooey sticker residue has come off, like little tiny bits of it, but I also now have this kind of wetness that I did not apply the Goo Gone directly to the cartridge, but
it's never going away.
Yeah, and that will probably dry with some level of... Where I think rubbing alcohol might not dry with... It'll evaporate before it discolors.
It will, but what'll happen is you'll see... Did you have color on the paper towel, which means it's a marker. So
But it's also a white portion.
I think it's just
the
wetness, getting it wet.
I mean, if you see any sort of coloration on the paper towel as you're wiping, stop immediately.
You're pulling the ink off the label.
You are, and that would be a bad thing.
Now, Goo Gone applied to this, like, actual sticker here on the plastic. If I let that sit for a while, I'll probably have a decent... Yeah.
Come for it off.
That removed the sticker residue from the plastic. So Goo Gone is... Certainly on plastic, pretty effective. My personal preference for removing store stickers or old label stickers, or even if hypothetically I wanted to completely, let's say if I was making a repro game that I was putting in this N64, and I want to completely cleanly remove something like this, which is physically impossible to peel off, lighter fluid. If you squirt lighter fluid on that on a flat surface and you let it sit for a good 2 minutes until the lighter fluid completely evaporates.
Away from open flame.
Completely away from open flames. Probably best to do it outside or in the garage or something.
Guess who the lawyer is?
It will seep through the paper and it will attack just the adhesion. And you'll be able to just like push the sticker off with your finger and it'll be like a piece of wet paper and there will be nothing left on the bottom. Maybe something you might need to wipe off with a paper towel and a little bit more lighter fluid. But lighter fluid is like the anti-sticker.
I've done that same thing with alcohol, but it's not that guaranteed.
Lighter fluid is...
Yeah,
it's good. Killer. It's really great. Awesome. You can get a little bottle of like Zippo lighter fluid for $2.
Yeah, we have tons of it in our house.
Yeah. So,
and another thing, stickers on cartridges, like this one back here.
Those bastards.
Sticker on a sticker.
Now, normally the way I get these off is I'll just peel off the sticker with my finger first, and if it's pretty intact, you could just put it right back on, peel it off again, and it gets off a lot of residue. I keep doing
that. By using the remaining sticky bit of the label, you're peeling what's off.
Exactly. You know, I do this like maybe 5 times, and then there's a certain point where it doesn't work anymore.
Sometimes it works.
And whatever's left, I just Goo Gone it right off.
Because it works. Yeah. That doing it that way works well on disc cases like PS2.
Yeah, it works PS3. Really well on GameStop stickers. Yeah. You know, because if you go to GameStop, of course, it's just you don't see the game; you just see all the used stickers because it's been there since the console launched. Mm-hmm. someone traded it in and it was $50.
Yeah, if you get a sticker within like the first week or so of it being applied, sometimes it'll come off easily. But you know, some of those stickers, if they're on for months.
Yeah, you have the yellow ones hidden beneath from when they switched.
Mm-hmm.
Like with those GameStop, so GameStop puts stickers on the. Like on a PS2 game, for example, it's on the paper. They don't even put it on the plastic. It's on the paper
inside. Sometimes, yes.
So you have to take the paper out to get it out. I think they have. But
and that's really annoying.
The way I get rid of those, which we probably would have gotten to anyway, is at home you might try this with a blow dryer. It might take you a long time to get the remaining adhesive wet enough to where you can get that label off. We use a heat gun here. It's not a great example for the general public because who has heat guns?
And you could light the actual paper on fire with the heat gun.
I use the same method on
it comes with the shrink wrap machine. It's probably a good $70 or $80.
If you use a heat gun, you got to keep them moving, right?
So yeah.
There's a couple of settings, and you have complete control over when it's blowing. It's not even a blow dryer you have less control over, but. Heat on those stickers will help get them sticky again, and that's the whole point. You want to get them back to the point where they're stickers and not paper attached to other paper. How about the coiling? Sort of a less, it's not so much cleaning, but it is sort of keeping your world clean.
What I'm going to do right now is like a cardinal sin. Don't
do
this.
That ruins.
Never do this because
as tight as you can do it.
This point right here is the tension point, and every time you wrap that coil around inside that controller on the circuit board, the cord is getting pulled tighter and tighter and more harder away from that circuit until this physically pops out. And we've all seen controllers like that. Joe, what is your best professional technique at coiling?
Mine's a little more. I know that yours is a little more simple, so this is a more.
I see the advanced
thing. And I've tried to show people in my store, and they sometimes take a little bit of time. You can almost do a video on this alone. The idea for me is that I want this thing to be in a place where I can throw the controller somewhere, and I know that wire isn't going to get tangled into anything else. It's its own entity. So mine is I am continuously building this set of loops up here until I get to the point where I'm going to start wrapping the loop up, which. This is probably a good spot, right? So I have this set of loops up top and a little bit of slack. Then the slack is going around. And this is usually the tricky part because the idea is that you want to make this as tight as you possibly can. So you're using your whole hand to get that really, really tight. And then when you get to the end, you pull that nice and tight and you push this through. And if you've done all that right, you pretty much have a knot that ain't going anywhere.
You can actually slide the noose coil up a little bit to lock it in place.
You can definitely play with it. And like Frankie said, this is the piece that you really don't want to mess around with the tension. You could do almost anything you want with this piece of the wire.
Yeah.
They're meant for that. But that's a nice tight. This is not. I could throw this in a box, and in 2 years, it's going to look exactly like that.
It's not going to get tangled with anything. Yeah. When you undo it, the cord is going to look still. It's not going to have
it's
like
have
a
weird wiry shape to it. Yeah. Like
a little bit,
But that doesn't last. Like that comes out.
You could straighten that out with a pen, actually.
You could.
Yeah.
How do you straighten that out with a pen?
Well, actually, we can even demonstrate that. Yep. Do you have a pen?
We do. There are pens.
Ho, do we have pens?
Yeah. So let's untangle this now. All right, so if you have a controller or any kind of wire
that has an inordinate amount of loops and kinks in it.
So, something like this. You're going to take your pen. You're going to make the Spock symbol. Mm-hmm. And you're actually going to do this.
Yeah.
And that straightens out the wire. This is actually something that electricians do when they're working on wires to make them nice and straight again.
I never even thought. So I do that at home all the time, and I never even really thought that that's something.
Yep, see, look at that.
This will help when you get those weird torqued controller wires.
Yep.
Now, my technique involves one extra part for my home collection for all of my electronics that are corded. I would recommend going to your Home Depot or your Lowe's, going to the section where they sell cabling. I believe you can find these things in the same place where they sell extension cords. They're Velcro zip ties. And they have soft Velcro on one side and a hard Velcro on the other. And they're little, like zip tie shaped things, those plastic things that you permanently cable tie something with. But they're made of Velcro. And you can cut them with the scissors to size, or they snap off in sections about this big. You get two rolls. I believe it's about $5. Each roll probably has about 100 on them. And I coil all of my controllers around my fingers. It's almost the same style as Joe does with those loops, but I don't ever use the cable itself to secure it. I get it to a point where it's done, and then I give it a pinch like that, and then I put the Velcro zip tie around it, and I put it in my drawer.
Yeah, you can get a big pack of those relatively cheap. Even a place like Micro Center sells them.
Yes, Micro Center. They're becoming more and more common, and it's great for, you know, putting your collection into hard storage, but I also keep a lot of stuff that I use on a regular basis coiled with that Velcro stuff. And it's just my wife laughs at how much I use those things. Like, every TV in our house, every electronic, every iPad, everything, I have those things. And
anything in the back of an entertainment cabinet like that, it's organize a mess if you don't have that. It's a mess if you don't have... Like, even just like bread ties or something like that. You know, anything to just keep those wires. If you have, you know, a TV, a cable box, you know, any kind of central hub for things, you know, computer or anything. It's a mess.
Yeah, that's why I use all those Velcro ties.
I don't use them because I'm constantly messing around with whatever I have back there. If I tied it up, it would take me an extra half hour to undo it all.
That's good. That's some of our basic techniques. Refurbishment 101.
Yep.
In Refurbishment 102, we'll show you how to iron an earthbound box. How to get all those nasty wrinkles out of a cardboard box. Actually, we can do that.
Change the pins on an NES. I've done it before.
You've ironed boxes?
I have. I have many times. Yep.
Nice.
So that'll be for our next our advanced session. So after everyone studies.
All right. So we are back, and unfortunately, we have a video game death.
A loss in the commercial world of video games. A person who many of us grew up seeing his art on the cover of, you know, probably most notably Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah, it's Greg Martin. Gregory Martin was he was an illustrator. He worked, I think originally he worked for Hanna-Barbera. Did a lot of Hanna-Barbera stuff. That's why a lot of his work in video games is a lot of Hanna-Barbera games. But he also did, it seemed like, you know, first of all, when he died, it was a friend of his who announced it on Nintendo Age forum. And at first I was like, well, I don't really remember hearing about this guy. I don't know who he is. But then it immediately like blew up, like Kotaku got it and Joystick and every site was talking about it. And, the amount of artwork that the man did for video games was staggering.
Yeah, if you go and you look, his cover art, I mean, he was certainly prolific in the 16-bit era with Sega Genesis, but he did a lot of stuff. Here is his work on Hudson's Adventure Island for the Game Boy. But it's probably a rare thing for someone to make a good living through that era. Doing this kind of, I would assume these are freelance projects. When a company needs a game artist to do a one-off, you know, you're not going to be a contract guy. You're not going to probably be working in a bullpen full of artists. You're going to be working from home. I know this as I was a graphic illustrator for many years, and it's sad to see a legacy like this and a legacy connected to classic gaming. And
I'm not exactly sure, but I almost think that because they were sharing on that forum, they were sharing a lot of concept art that people found that he did and things like that. And to me, it seemed like he actually designed, you want to call it graphically, the Sonic look that you see in these game on these covers and you've seen for the last 20 years. You know, the infamous Sonic kind of artwork. But I think one of the things that made him, you know, so good was that he was also, an artist for, animation.
Sure.
So that's why so many of his games, for instance, the covers look like animated characters, or they were actually licensed of animated characters. And they're just showing there the Jetsons and Felix the Cat and the Flintstones. Did a lot with the Flintstones. Yeah.
All the Adventure Island games. Yeah. A lot of stuff for Capcom, Snow Brothers, DuckTales, Little Nemo, Dream Master cover. Yeah,
unbelievable.
It's sad, and it's an unsung job. It's something you do. I mean, it's like pulp art in the 1940s.
I mean, if you were to look
it's,
in
it's a, throwaway almost it, until it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, if you looked in one of the, of course, none of these have the manual, but if you looked in the game manual, would you see this man's name in there? I don't know that you would.
Possibly.
And yet he was in so many of these games.
There are no Drew Struzans in the box art world. There are very, if any, there are very few.
I don't know if it's. I mean, would you even see it in the credits of a game? Like, cover art designed by Greg Martin?
Possibly not. Yeah, probably, not most likely no, I'd say. And maybe in an era where, you know, maybe in the PS2 era, you'd probably see, you know, illustration credits in a robust game manual. But now we're in an era with no game manuals, so.
Right.